Beth, thank you for joining us on Women's Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Many of us are watching our parents age or die, and we're in the midst of trying to help them. So how is that informing baby boomers and my generation, just slightly behind the baby boomers, about aging and what they want their own aging to look like?
Until fairly recently, we basically had three options when we were old. If our family members wanted to take us in, we could do that. We could move to a traditional retirement community. Some of them are active adult, and some have the levels of care, the continuing care retirement communities. Or we could live alone, which often meant being isolated and very lonely. And that's why I push back a bit against this aging in place as the way we should view our futures. I really think we should think in terms of aging in community. Mm-hmm. And that community might be our long-term homes in our long-term neighborhoods, or like co-housing, it could be a brand new community. Often aging in place means being lonely and isolated. And we have to really be proactive about having social connections as we grow older, because the research is showing that loneliness and isolation is actually bad for our health. It's bad for our immune systems, our blood pressure, all sorts of measures. And in contrast, people with strong social connections enjoy many health benefits in addition to the obvious having a lot of friends.
If you don't have children, especially.
Yes, yes. And as a matter of fact, co-housing, as just one example, has been pointed out to me as a great way to live if you're shy or introverted or have a hard time making friends. You sort of have built-in friends in these communities.
You know, as I joked with all my older siblings, I'm 48, as we've wrestled with our parents' aging dilemmas, that since baby boomers have touted themselves as this great demographic wave going through society and changing things, so I said, I'm counting on you all to figure this out before I get there. And I think that's a factor in your book. People
yes.
are becoming innovative about
yes.
these ideas.
I'm 62, so I am a baby boomer. And I think you can overstate, you know, the case. However, I do believe that my generation has a track record of not being afraid of change, of being willing to reimagine how we do things, whether it's childbirth when we were young adults, to starting food co-ops, all sorts of things we've reimagined. And I think we will want to revision how we age.
If we can just admit that we're aging.
That's the big if.
Yeah.
And one of the things I really hope people who are listening will take hold of is that denial about our aging is not our friend. The more we're in denial, the more we're vulnerable to being alone and isolated when we grow old or having to move to institutions that might not be of our choosing. And it's not a panacea, but I think the more proactive we are, the better off we'll be.
Well, let's talk about some of the models that you looked at, the Villages model.
The Villages is one of the fastest growing models. It's a membership organization based on a neighbors helping neighbors concept. So you pay dues in most villages, and for that, you have access to one central number that you call if you need help. And by help, I mean non-medical help. So transportation, of course, is the big thing that all villages get the most requests for. But it could be anything from dog walking to maybe temporarily needing some meals if you just got out of the hospital. So there's help, but there's also a lot of social activities. It's a way to feel connected to your neighbors. And another great aspect of the Village model and some of the other models is it gives the members themselves a sense of purpose and belonging, because a lot of the volunteers are the members. It's not this whole way of thinking of old people as just these passive recipients, pitiful people that need help. I think we have to bust through that and see older people as folks who are contributing and have a lot to offer.
And then there's co-housing.
Co-housing is different. That's an intentional community. So this is for people who say, you know, I don't mind moving from my longtime neighborhood. These communities are designed architecturally and organizationally to foster friendship. So they're designed to have smaller households, could be an apartment or a townhouse. And generally, these surround large common spaces. So every co-housing community has the option of once a week, everybody in the community will eat dinner together, for example. So there's a big commercial kitchen and dining area. Or there might be a large den where 20 of you could watch a movie, a documentary together.
If you so choose.
If you chose. Both the village model and co-housing, there's about 120 existing and another almost equal number in formation. But that's a little bit false equivalency because a village will serve many hundreds of people, where co-housing, it's just a handful of families generally.
And the co-housing is usually like a condominium model, right?
Legally, yes.
Okay.
But there are variations to that. Some are cooperatives. Some offer rentals, affordable rentals. Others are all purchase. Most are multi-generational. Some are just for older people.
And you mentioned cooperatives. That's another model that you looked at.
Yes. These are especially popular in certain areas, like the upper Midwest, for example. Also, Washington State has senior housing cooperatives.
And how do they work?
It's similar. People might say, well, what's the difference between that and a condominium? To me, the difference is there's a much stronger sense of ownership of these communities and control. So they really are member-owned and controlled and have more of a common good sense about them than I think your typical condominium association would have.
And so, they are in rural and in urban areas.
They are.
Okay.
They are. And one of the studies about them showed, again, strong health benefits. People had a sense of purpose. A lot of these models, the older people still have a strong sense of control about their destinies. And I think that gets harder in some of the traditional retirement communities and certainly in long-term care.
And the cooperatives is people might own – it might be a grouping of homes, but the cooperative owns the land?
Basically.
Okay.
That's right. And one of the ones I visited that was really fun was in Central Oregon, and it was what people would call a trailer park, although folks who live there prefer the term manufactured housing cooperative. And their land was going to be sold out from under them, which is terrible. You think you have a stable home, and suddenly you don't. So a nonprofit organization assisted them in forming a cooperative, and they were able to buy the land instead of it being sold to a developer. And through this process, it's not simply, oh, now they own the land. They've gotten closer as a community. They help each other in ways that they didn't before.
I think one of the metaphors someone used in your book was in terms of condominiums versus cooperatives. Condominiums is like everyone lashes their boats together to sail on, and the cooperative is like, well, we're all in the same ship.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
we succeed or fail
yeah.
together. So
that's a good image.
And then cooperatives, I was surprised there's 6,400 in the U.S. made up of 1.2 million dwellings, and of those, about 425,000 are created to be affordable.
Yes. So the one I visited in Oregon, New Hampshire has a bunch of these that they are considered officially affordable housing by their state or local entities. And that entitles them to some tax breaks and some other financial benefits. And it's also the main source of affordable housing, I'm going back now to the manufactured home parks. It's the main source of affordable housing in rural America, which I don't think most people realize that. So if you can combine that with a cooperative ownership, it's a great model for people without a lot of money who want to live where they want to live.
And then you have a really intriguing one, NORCs.
Naturally occurring retirement communities. And this is very familiar to people, I think, who live in suburbs, also cities. These are neighborhoods where you raised your kids and then you just never left. Well, what may have been a great house when you were raising your kids, it's not so great when you're getting older. So these naturally occurring retirement communities are places with a critical mass of older people who have aged in place. And they're similar to the village in that they provide services for folks to help them stay where they want to stay. But what's different, instead of it being a membership organization that you pay dues to, these NORCs are run by cities or nonprofits, and they serve all the older people in that area. The main difference is the village is a nonprofit that you join and pay dues. The NORC is an entity that everybody there gets served.
There's a huge one in New York City.
Yeah, it was fabulous. I was very impressed. I was ready to move to New York.
Really?
Yeah, it was great.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of the places that you talk about were fascinating. I mean, you know, I want to live there. They had, it's nothing like bingo and shuffleboard. There's people doing yoga and art classes and theater.
And all these cool intergenerational programs with all kinds of schools in New York, from the elementary school across the street to the Fashion Institute, where very high quality programs where the older folks and the younger people are working on projects together. I think that's so exciting.
I was intrigued by one of the models you looked at, and I don't know how replicable this is. It's in Illinois, and it's called Hope Meadows.
That, to me, is the single most inspiring model I found. This was started by a woman named Brenda E. Hart, who is an academic whose specialty had been how to improve the foster care system. And she was sick of seeing these foster children, despite the good intentions of the social service system, languishing. So she imagined a new way that these kids could live. And basically that way was normalcy. How can we create normalcy for these kids? So she formed an intentional community that's comprised of adoptive families who want to adopt children out of the foster care system and older people who act as kind of bonus grandparents to these families. She took over an abandoned Air Force base and fixed up the housing a bit. And everybody lives there in close proximity, but they're still part of the wider Rantoul, Illinois community. And they've had amazing success with these kids in very rapidly relaxing, feeling safe and secure, feeling a connection with the other foster kids who are being adopted, but then really reaching out and forming wonderful bonds with these older people who live there for reduced rent in exchange for volunteering for the community. And it is replicable. There's now one called Bridge Meadows in Portland, Oregon, and one called Treehouse in East Hampton. It's in Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
And she's eager, and in fact, she's formed a nonprofit called Generations of Hope, whose goal is to expand this model.
That's a great idea. I was very impressive. There's one woman who moved from San Diego to Rantoul, Illinois.
I know. She loved it. And she'd been there several years and planned to die there. I mean, she loved it. And in fact, several of the people I interviewed, well, everyone who I interviewed, they wanted to stay there forever.
Did you find evidence that people were able to live out their lives in these alternative places or methods, or at least forestall going to a long-term care facility?
Definitely forestall. And I did hear evidence from, for example, the Penn South Cooperative, where they used to have people disappearing in ambulances and never returning. And now because of this raft of services available, they're able to keep people there,
mm-hmm.
almost everybody. There are a couple really exciting developments that I think bode well for our future. One is an outfit called Full Circle America in Maine. And this was started by a physician who, again, was frustrated with the long-term care system and thought he could do better. And this is an organization that serves its members through technology, in-home technology.
Yeah, this was fascinating.
Off the shelf. These are not sophisticated systems. It's a webcam and a simple Skype, a mm-hmm. touchscreen kind of Skype. He combines this with, again, a close community network of volunteers, people from the person's church, family members, whoever that individual knows. And between the technology and this little network of support, he's convinced people can stay in their own homes, almost everybody, until the end. And I did go up there. I visited a woman who has profound dementia, and she was still living in her own home. And she, you know, we looked at the webcam and everything, and she said she didn't quite understand what that was. But her daughter said when she visited her daughter, they could watch the woman's cat on the screen through the webcam, which she found delightful. Another man I visited who had not cognitive problems but physical problems, I said, well, doesn't it feel weird to have these cameras in your home? And he said, you know, it really doesn't. It makes me feel secure.
Mm-hmm.
The cameras are placed strategically so that it's not a total invasion of someone's privacy. But we're also talking about folks who would likely be in a nursing home type setting, where I can assure you, you don't have a lot of privacy mm-hmm. anyway.
So is the idea, like, who's accessing the webcams to watch them, just check up on them?
Right. These are paid employees of Full Circle America who are specially trained. And they check, depending on the person's condition, they check throughout the day. It's not like somebody's nonstop mm-hmm. staring. That would be prohibitive cost-wise. But they check maybe 5 times a day. And then if some people also need some paid home health aids. But they found it's so much more affordable than moving to either assisted living or, of course, a nursing home.
Well, assisted living can easily, depending on where you are in the country, run you $6,000 a month if you're renting
This is
apartment.
More like $1,000 a month. Well,
wow.
For one, you're not providing the room and board, so that's one reason it's so much cheaper. But also what they found, studies have found that, say, in a nursing home, which is supposed to be the most intensive level of care, the actual hands-on care is like an hour and 15 minutes in a 24-hour period. So if you can pay a home health worker for a discrete amount of time like that, maybe prepare a couple meals and do some other support, it's far cheaper.
So this is in Maine. Is this a model that could be replicated or is being replicated?
Well, he's smart. He really wanted it replicated. And he thought, given our healthcare system, which is a private healthcare system, he basically made it like a franchise. So he's eager for other folks to replicate. It's like a turnkey approach.
Mm-hmm.
He's got it all set up for you. You just have to be willing to start this small business that serves people in their homes. One other option I'd like to mention is there's an alternative nursing home that's been created. It's a small house model. So instead of the big institution, it houses maybe 10 people with specially trained staff. The village in Capitol Hill, near where I live in Washington, D.C., they're looking at trying to get one of these greenhouses smack in the middle of their neighborhood. So for those people who really can't continue to live on their own. They could move into this home and still be surrounded by their neighbors and people who have known them for years that will still visit them. So I really think that's another promising model. Basically, I also think technology is going to give us options we can't even dream of that will allow us to stay in our own homes. And soon.
You mentioned robots.
I know. I visited my first caregiving robot at Georgia Tech. It's got a ways to go. But whether it's robots, whether it's sensors around our home that will pick up if we haven't gotten out of bed in 24 hours. Mm-hmm. There was an example in Maine where an older woman with cognitive problems almost froze to death in her own home because the furnace went out and she didn't have the wherewithal to do anything about it. Well, now our homes can have sensors where someone 1,000 miles away would be able to tell, uh-oh, grandma's furnace hasn't come on, and get help.
You look at a lot of different models in this book because there's all kinds of permutations, less formal models, house sharing, going back to multi-generations under one roof because the kids are moving back home, or a mother-in-law suite, or whatever you want to call
it. I think house sharing is probably the fastest-growing model. We may not pay attention to it quite as much, but all of a sudden there's been a flurry of news media attention. Some networks are being formed. There's one called the Golden Girls Network that just got launched, a website. It's basically a Match.com for folks to find roommates, housemates. There's also versions that are established by nonprofits that link an older person with a home who's struggling to maintain it with a younger person looking for affordable housing. So the younger person moves, gets a room, and exchange for very low rent helps the older person as needed. That's a great model.
And this nonprofit model would screen?
They screen people, and they are also there to mediate problems. I think they help up front. They help people discuss expectations. There's some really cool women in Pittsburgh who have a book called My House, Our House that I highly recommend. And they were three friends who moved in together, but they were really smart about thinking ahead of time about what potential problems might crop up, such as somebody's grown child decides they want to crash there, or somebody has a new romance and the other two don't like, you know, eating mm-hmm. their Cheerios with some stranger at the breakfast table. And they thought through all these potential problems and wrote down, well, what would we do to solve them before they ever moved in together?
You know, I lived in an intentional community for a year when I was a volunteer, and it's challenging. So there's a lot of things you have to work through.
That's the thing. None of these models are easy or perfect, because I don't think you can get humans in close proximity and not have the potential for problems. But I think what we need to compare them to is the problem of living alone and isolated and old. And to me, that's a much bigger problem than working out human relationships. And there's so many benefits to working those problems out and living in close relationships with people.
You also just looked at the idea of like sort of going with your tribe, quote unquote.
Oh, yes.
With your affinity groups. I mean, it could be LGBTQ. You found a community of retired postal workers in Florida. It could be people who have, you know, shared kind of academic interests. And that was kind of interesting. I know you included an LGBT community here called Birds of a Feather.
Yes.
Near Pecos.
Yes. And what really impressed me was not only did they love the birds of a feather, they felt safe, secure, very happy there, but they weren't trying to set themselves apart from the rest of the world. They were really involved in the Pecos community. They all had incredible volunteer things they were doing. So they were both connected to the wider community, but they had their own place, which is particularly important for gay people because of historic discrimination in retirement communities and in long-term care. Mm-hmm. So for people to be able to grow old and be themselves is really important for them. One that I just visited on my book tour in Livingston, Texas was for RV, lifetime RVers, and that was great. And these were folks who had been in their RVs as their only home for decades. But you get to a point and you can't just hit the road anymore. But that was home to them. So this little community called Escapees Care is a nonprofit where 35 RVers live in their own homes, their own RVs, mm-hmm. but they go to a community center to get their meals, to have all kinds of activities. And the feeling of closeness among the people there, it actually was quite moving. One lady said to me, you know, your family sometimes, they're there for you out of a sense of obligation. But here, nobody's obligated. They do it out of love. And it was very touching. It was a sweet community.
Hmm. You know, this is a very uplifting book. But there are downsides, too, to some of the scenarios you looked at.
There was one in Oregon I visited that had turned out to be pretty disastrous. In that case, it was an owner mm-hmm. who was really had issues, had psychological problems, and was making life miserable for everyone who lived there. And these were people who had pulled up stakes and moved there thinking this will be their last community. These were mostly gay men, and they felt trapped. They didn't have a lot of financial resources to move elsewhere. And that was a real cautionary tale that you really do have to look into any option, especially if you're pulling up stakes and moving. You really have to know mm-hmm. as much as you possibly can. I always think it's a good idea to, if you own a place, don't sell it. You know, try your new community and you know, if you can rent mm-hmm. there. Try it out and make sure it's a good fit, because it's not always easy to go back.
You have a great list of questions at the end of the book, just for people to start thinking about. What do you want your aging to look like?
Right. So do we want to stay in our longtime neighborhoods, or do you really feel like shaking up the dice and moving? Do you want to live around children, or do they drive you crazy mm-hmm. and you'd really prefer to live among people your own age? There's how big a concern are your finances? For some people, it's a huge concern. Well, there's options in my book that are extremely affordable. There's options at the end of those questions. I then guide the reader to which options they might want to check out.
And you have do you have sort of links to some of these organizations or trade groups or things on your website?
Yes, at bethbaker.net. I have it's called a page called Community Links, where you can find many, many of these options. Some have national organizations with directories. Almost everyone in there you could link to. You could also contact me, and I could help put you in touch if you can't find it on your own.
And did you have a sense of just in terms of nationally a momentum around any policy issues that are trying to address some of these? These are sort of grassroots innovations coming from various places. Do you think any of these are going to be enshrined more formally in policy?
Well, I don't think any of the particular housing options will, but these housing options exist in a larger environment. And there are some forward-thinking communities that are seeking to become age-friendly. Some are called age-friendly. Some are called lifelong communities. The World Health Organization has something called age-friendly cities. And there are a few. Washington, D.C. is one. New York City's one. Portland's one that are seeking that status mm-hmm. to be officially considered age-friendly. They're looking at things like walkability. They're looking at are parks friendly to older people, or are they scary places for older people? This whole idea of creating within any city small areas where people can walk to for shopping, libraries, this whole suburban model from my own childhood, it just doesn't work for older people. it's too car dependent. So a lot of cities are looking at their city through a lens that they never looked through before, which is, can we serve people till the end of their lives? And I think it's very hopeful, but I think people need to pick up the pace. Mm-hmm. We are getting old. And those that are just starting to, well, maybe think about this. You know, it could take 20 years. Mm-hmm. And that's with a good plan of how you're going to get there. So I really hope a lot more cities get on board with this.
Well, and of course, we live in a very rural state. And we're in Albuquerque. It's the biggest city. But many people are not even near any kind of good public transportation or walkability. So some of these other models might be the answer for them.
That's true. But any model, you're going to have to figure out the transportation piece. Mm-hmm. And it is especially challenging in rural areas, that's for sure.
Well, Beth, I want to thank you for coming and talking with us.
Thank you.
And Beth Baker's book is With a Little Help from Our Friends, Creating Community as We Grow Older. Thanks, Beth.
Thank you.